Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. I want to go out and talk with one of our writers today, who has written several wonderful books, funny, droll, moving, and they include the collection of stories, Reading, Writing, and Leaving Home, The Curse of the Appropriate Man, House of Women, The Mirror, Home Ground, Friends of the Family. Her new novel is called The Servants' Quarters, and it's set just after World War II, and it's the story of a young girl, Cressida, and the coming-of-age story in a household filled with a man who has survived a brutal scarring in World War II and nightmares and a world of servants. The book is called The Servants' Quarters. Please welcome Lynn Freed to West Coast Live. This is a very moving and funny book, and in a way, and it's set in an entirely different world than people in the Western world nowadays might know, a world of servants' quarters, a world of servants.
Right, well, this was my world. It's a world I know well. And I used to frequent the servants' quarters quite often. Seemed to be another life going on in there that intrigued me.
And what part of the world was this?
South Africa. Yeah.
And you were, and this book is set shortly after World War II. Is there something that, I mean, this is something that's not often discussed on public radio, which is how to deal with servants.
I was once asked when there was still a HERS column in the New York Times. They said they wanted a column on servants and who to do this better than me. I thought, oh God, how to accomplish this without offending someone. There is no way to accomplish a discussion on servants without offending somebody. So I actually talked about my difficulties in handling what is never known as servants, help in America, because in America people are helped, and having someone who cleans my house, who's help, was extremely difficult for me, regardless of the fact that I had grown up in a household with five or six servants. I didn't know what to do with her. Her name was wonderfully Purificacion. And
Purificacion is a house cleaner.
Purificacion. And she was a wonderful woman, but I realized after a while it was as awkward for her as it was for me. It was her first cleaning job. She didn't know where her world ended and mine began. We never worked it out. So really, that's what I wrote about.
Yeah. So was that space somehow more defined than when you were growing up?
The space?
The space between servants and householders?
In South Africa? Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Much more clearly defined. And it still is, despite the new South Africa. The whole culture of servants goes on there. It's not the only country in the world, you know. Think of Brazil, think of all the other countries that routinely have servants.
Certainly there are Americans who've enjoyed their expatriate life, say, in Southeast Asia, having a household of servants.
Absolutely. Yeah. But maybe they're called help there, too. You can get by with a lot of euphemisms.
Yeah. Yeah.
But servants were another life in the household, and actually sort of wonderful ones. Well, I know, having brought a child up in this country, that I'd probably have been much less irascible if I'd had a nanny to take her off my hands fairly often.
When you would go to the servants' quarters growing up for yourself, how was that life different from life in your main house?
Oh, God, in every way. I mean, even the toilets were different. There was a toilet that was a hole in the floor, like Turkish toilets. You know. And the room, there were several rooms, each servant had a room. The rooms were furnished with our cast-offs. So it was interesting to go and see the cast-offs. It was awkward. I'm sure it was awkward for them, but it was sort of wonderful for me because it was a world in which different food was eaten, different language was spoken, which I understood only a little of, which was in this case Zulu. And I had a freer hand there than I had in the big house.
In your novel, the Cressida seems to be one of these sort of interstitial characters. So she's able to move between both worlds with relative ease, and is able to eavesdrop and tries to piece together what's going on as she tries to come to understand the world. One of the characters is a man who his head was terribly deformed in an incident in World War II, and he wears a hat with a veil for much of the book. At some points, it gets discarded.
Yes, and he was an RAF pilot who was shot down and burned, badly burned. In her case, with the servants' quarters, a different phenomenon. There's a lot of discussion of class in this novel, and she comes from a family that's come down on its luck. And so this particularly disfigured man with a lot of money fixes up his old servants' quarters, as opposed to the new ones where the servants live, for them to live in, which the mother, who is rather pretentious, claims was once a carriage house. Anyway, so they live in what was the servants' quarters, although they aren't servants. And the main character is really terribly interested in class and how to extract herself from the class she's been born into and rise, which she does by hook and crook.
There's a reference to Cressida riding a bus, and she's in the European seating. What is the European seating?
Well, when I was growing up in South Africa, which was before and during apartheid, Europeans was the term for whites. So European seating would be where the whites were allowed to sit on the buses. The blacks were allowed to sit upstairs. They were double-decker British buses at the back. So that's what European would have meant. Over the years, with the coming of political correctness to South Africa, in a very mild way during apartheid, the name for blacks changed continually. First of all, when I grew up, they were the natives, and then that was considered wrong. Then they were the Africans. And then they came up with a term that didn't last too long but was hilarious, plurals, because...
Plurals?
Plurals, P-L-U-R-A-L-S, because there were so many tribes that they felt that they needed to give them plural identities. So.
There's a way in which language shapes the way we perceive the world and the way that our perceptions shape the language. Were these all sort of ways of trying to help the Europeans feel more comfortable with their presence in and amongst the blacks?
I think what we're talking about is a version of political correctness, yes. I mean, it's cheap to change the language and keep everything else the same. And I think it's not special to South Africa. It drives me mad here when terms are changed simply to make things seem less terrible. I mean, in a completely different way, take the word issue. There are no longer any problems in the world. There are only issues. And I'm constantly carrying on about this. But it's part of a vast phenomenon of self-inflation or the inflation.
Well, there's also the way concerns... So replaced worries. Do you have worries? You have concerns. What are your concerns?
Yes. My concerns are quite different from my worries, as are my issues from my problems.
Well, maybe you can explain a nice little turn of phrase here. That was something. Somebody is described as being as common as dust fat.
Fat.
Oh, that. Dust fat.
Dust fat. That has to be a typo. Good.
Is that a typo? I like that one.
That's incredible.
Duck fat? Should it have been duck fat?
No, there should have been no fat in there.
Wait, I circled it because no, I've where to go here. I very carefully circled it.
It's bad enough when the publishers interfere with one's commas, but when they start inserting fat.
What do you, how do you, have you had disputes with publishers about commas?
Oh, heavens, yes. I mean, I'm very fond of my commas, and they are very unfond of them, so they keep removing them.
So a comma to you means what in the course of your sentence?
A breath, where to take a breath. I mean, apart from the logic of grammar, whereby it flanks a phrase that should be flanked. It's where to take a breath. I mean, English grammar is fairly flexible, unlike French grammar. So one can put commas where one likes, and I like them.
Commas have their place. I mean, it's no question about that.
Semicolons. So do semicolons and colons. No one uses them anymore. They take those out, too.
The semicolon has got a very specific function, too. I mean, different from a colon. A colon is kind of like an equal sign.
Exactly, exactly. And a colon is like a sort of tennis net, you know, the net in tennis. But the semicolon links several clauses, really. I could go on.
Oh, no, I think this is interesting because, I mean, in a way, I mean, these are the building blocks of a story, and they describe the pace and they help establish a character and a pattern of thought.
No question. Yeah. Absolutely. It is a way of pacing the prose, especially with a complex sentence. It seems to me that a lot of prose is written these days without complex sentences, where the bits are broken down into small. I suppose it's another way of writing. Yeah.
What are the functions of the nightmares for Cressida in the book?
She's a girl who grew up, who was born at the end of the Second World War, and whose parents were. She grew up in South Africa, so she was beyond the reach of the Holocaust. But she's obsessed with the Holocaust, based largely on a couple of books that her mother has been given, And really, it's I think not something that was unusual for Jewish children born in countries like South Africa who found out about the Holocaust and realized the narrow wall between, not even a wall, the integument between themselves and what could have happened to them had they by some chance been born somewhere else. I mean, my parents landed up in South Africa by sort of accident. My father's parents were English Jews. My mother's parents were from Lithuania, and they happened to leave during the pogroms. But they could have just as easily have moved somewhere else in Europe and be gone. Mm-hmm. So I think, in a sense, the girl is obsessed with it. She also is fascinated by the grotesque photographs, which a child is. I mean, they're almost pornographic. And so they...
Of the victims of the Holocaust.
Yes, of the victims. And so they become part of... ongoing nightmares for her.
The role of Jews in South Africa, was that where did that? I mean, there was a separate kind of country club. Somebody was, you know, in your novel was got in at the, you know, a special request of somebody else. I mean, were Jews, you know, sort of their own hierarchy and had their own kind of quasi apartheid in South Africa?
Yes, I think when I was growing up, it was much like what I believe to be the history of Jews in America, that at first they were not allowed into certain institutions, hospitals, as doctors and so forth and so forth. But over the years, these barriers tended to come down. So yes, they have their own, and still do have their own country clubs and so forth. But there's much more blending now. Well, certainly when I was growing up, in the face of the greater worry, which was going to be the revolution that never happened.
Have you been back to South Africa as a, you know, as a grown-up then?
Oh, heavens, yes, many, many times. I used to go very often when my parents were alive and felt in a way as if I had two homes. Then they died and it changed, but I still go back because I love the place. So, yes, I do.
What kind of a person was your father?
Oh, my father was an odd duck for a Jewish South African. He was sent by his parents to school in England when he was about 9. He went to public school, which of course is not public school here, and then he went on to Cambridge, and so he was sort of educated as a gentleman. He never got over it. he was a very beautiful man who was just adored being adored by anybody, women, men. He was an actor in his spare time, and he came back from England and was more or less forced to take over his father's business. He was one of the world's worst businessmen. On principle, for instance, they sold cameras. He would not stock either German or Japanese cameras, which left Kodak, you know. So he was quite eccentric.
And your mother, was she also theatrical?
My mother was a professional actress, and she had gone to RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, when she was a girl, and to the Royal College of Music as a singer. And she ran a reps company and a a theatre school, and she did productions all the time. There was no television when I was growing up in South Africa. It only came in the mid-70s. So there was a lot of radio theatre, and my parents were very much involved with that. I mean, they were almost never home at night because that's when they recorded. Most of the actors had other jobs, day jobs, which is what I'm always telling people they should keep. But anyway, so they were off rehearsing at night, and I heard their voices constantly on the radio. Oddly enough, I mean, the servants would come because there were a lot of radio serials, soaps, the equivalent of soaps, to ask what was going to happen next, because the servants would move from room to room with a plug-in radio and listen to the serials. And my parents would tell them what was going to come next, so it would be all around the neighborhood.
Your parents sound very entertaining, engaging.
Oh, they were utterly entertaining. They're both dead now, but they were completely entertaining. They were a sort of dog and pony show.
And what about your upbringing drove you, compelled you to be a writer? A more solitary life?
I don't know that writing is so solitary. It should be, but, I mean, one's among people all the time. But I had no desire to go on the stage, that's for sure, although I was shoved onto the stage from a very early age. But I can't remember wanting to write, although a friend from school, the other Jewish girl in my class, we had a quota, two per class, the other Jewish girl...
Two per class.
Two per class. Was told me years later that I had always said I wanted to be a writer, but I don't remember that at all. I don't know how it happened. I just wrote.
You just wrote. Where did the idea of a man disfigured in the war come from?
This character was with me through many versions of the beginning of this novel. He was the only one who abided. When I was a girl, my father had two friends who must have been at college with him, who had been in the RAF, one of whom was severely disfigured by burns. And he completely terrified me as a child. I was the youngest of the children. And he, unfortunately, adored children, so he was always wanting to play. And it was the horror of my life that this man used to come for lunch and so forth. And he was. They were British, so they must have been coming through South Africa on a ship or something, because then they went away and I was immensely relieved. But that was the beginning of this character. It has nothing else to do with that. But that thence came the burns.
As a character, you make him appealing to women. Mm. There's an interesting sort of mother-daughter scene that sort of takes place about over kind of a cotton frock and a shopping expedition, but really it's about the attentions of this man.
Oh, well, that scene, I mean, shopping scenes I love to write because I love to shop. And yeah. And women, it seems to me from discussions, have an audience in mind when they shop. Some women hate shopping, but that's another matter. But in any case, these are both women who've had an affair with the same man, mother and a daughter. I think too little has been written about the appeal of a grotesque man.
But one of the points you make is that people will sometimes overcome revulsion for money.
Oh, yes, that too. Yeah. Indeed. That may have been the case with the mother. I think with the daughter, she really actually does fall in love with this man. And he's sort of wonderful.
And the mother she knows what's going on with the daughter, gets really angry about it and says, I will not hem your frock for you.
Yes.
Which but no, seemed...
No fat in there, yeah.
No fat in there. So the book is called The Servant's Quarters. The author is Lynn Fried, and she lives and writes here in California. And it's it really is an entirely different world. I mean, not only is there no television in it, I don't remember any sort of radio being in it. There is music that's played in the house, only on a piano. There's a completely different kind of pace and feel and temperature and way of being in the world. I mean, her... Cressida's father is laid out from an accident we learn about later on, which is kind of nutty in its own way. But there are servants who bathe his feet with oils. They admire him and love him, even though they have to change his diaper.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yes, it is. There are strange people in this novel. It is a strange world compared to this world that we live in now, and compared to the world that's there now. But there it is, strange world with other other types, other people, and other rules.
Thank you very much for being here on West Coast Live. Lynn Freed.
Thank you. The
book is called The Servant's Quarters, published by HMH. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.